So, a little bit of background. Some of you, I don't think, have been in a session with me, so for those of you who haven't, bear with it, and I'll go through the same little story, as well as talk about my own theological views in their formative stage. And one of the important things to understand about me is I grew up on a farm, a ranch, and throughout my youth was in 4-H and raised animals. We had, you know, all the standard things you expect on a farm: cattle, chickens, pigs, as well as pear orchards. And so I grew up with the idea that we take from life and or to live, and things die, and die of natural processes, die of harvest. And that's not something that is at all foreign or objectionable, even. It's messy, is all. Messy process, but that's life. So that informs my views on religion. And then I went into forestry. I got a degree in forestry at the University of California, Berkeley. Worked summers for the U.S. Forest Service and the forest products industry. Worked in the Redwood region for 3 years as a field forester, and then in the spirit of the 60s looked at what was happening to the forests of the Redwood region as a result of a rather rapacious industry. There was a lot of wrecked land and a lot of wrecked people left behind. And so I really want to look at the social aspects of forestry, social and political dynamics. So I could go crashing through the brush. I was, you know, I was a really good forester. And I could go crashing through the brush all day long, and I loved it. Just absolutely loved that work. But it could all come to naught because of some decision made outside of the profession. And that prophecy, if you will, has come through in spades, where foresters today are largely immobilized in a lot of what we do. What we do is governed by law and regulation, and there's very little discretion for professional judgment. And we'll talk about law today in the context of greeting the church. So I went to Yale, studied philosophy, social philosophy, existentialism, phenomenology, and systems ecology, and drove myself over the edge talking to myself. And Yale fortunately hired a sociologist who I started to work with, and so I've been mixed sociology and forestry ever since. And with a PhD at Berkeley, was able to get into the teaching profession and taught at Washington for the last 30 years, and have recently retired. I've done administration, done a lot of travel internationally, and in a lot of the travel I've done, including where I discovered this picture, it's actually a really beautiful church, that religion has a lot to do with forests. And we can't understand religion and can't understand the dynamics of a society that interacts with forests in very unique ways until we understand what that society's basic beliefs are. And so over the last 30 years, I've grown increasingly convinced that we have to understand the religious frame, whether that is formally religious in the traditional sense, or whether it's secular religion, popular beliefs that are tightly held, and if we want to understand the forests. And I've been talking about that here for the last couple of weeks. And today is the last of the talks I'll have, and we'll discuss a topic that will be independent of all I've said. So if you're new, you don't need to worry about what's gone on before, and if you've been to some of the other sessions, it'll build on that. And also a little note here on my personal theology. And I've been a member of an Episcopal church-sponsored discussion group called Education for Ministry, where we develop our own sense of personal ministry. And it's a four-year study course. Some of you may be familiar with that. EFM, the short Education for Ministry. Read all the whole Bible over 2 years, and then the history of Christianity over the next 2 years. And out of that, we had to write a personal theology. What is your personal theology? And mine, as a scientist and as someone with a strong Christian sense of ethics and belief, ended up talking about God as creative process. And what I've learned here last week after I've shared this with people is they say I'm a process theologian or something. And I'm not a theologian. I'm a forester. 50 years of experience in forestry, And I've dabbled a little bit and beginning to understand more and more theology, as it's important to explore that interface between what we know about forestry and what we know about religion and society. And part of the process that we're going to look at today, which is really important in terms of my belief, is that our stewardship needs to be rooted in action. In that sense, I really like Bonhoeffer, which is social action, but mine is working with creation. So where we sustain, extend, and enhance life, our stewardship role is to sustain, extend, and enhance life, and all of life. And to get a feeling for that, there are a couple things. I like to work with wood, and then I've been, as my wife Trudy knows, I spent the last 40 years collecting piles of wood to work on at the time when I was in my active professional life. So now it's stacked in the garage, and I'm in retirement starting to go to work on it.
There you go.
Well, I've been inspired in that by a Japanese woodworker who lives in Pennsylvania. I don't know if he's still alive. We honored him at the University of Washington 7 years ago. Nakashima, who has a book called The Soul of the Tree, where you take the wood and you get a beautiful piece of wood and you extend the life of that tree into something that humans can not only find useful, but inspiring and beautiful. So you take the soul of the tree, you understand that piece, and you work. The piece of wood has to come not from some abstract design, but literally grow out of that natural form. So if the soul is protected, preserved, extended, that's one way of looking at this sense of stewardship with material things. And the other sense is in working with nature. Any of us who have gardened have taken a piece of soil that may be not very productive, and we enhance it with amendments, make it more productive. And I'm very interested in our place, which we're developing in our retirement, of experimenting with what some have described as terra preta, which is what the Mayans did. They were discovering the Mayans were very sophisticated farmers and gardeners. They burned charcoal, powdered it, made charcoal and powdered it, and added it to soil, and perhaps even transferred soil organisms from one place to another to develop deep, dark, very productive soils. And they found these pockets in Central America, Brazil, and places of soils that mystify people. How did they get there? There's no natural process that can explain it. Well, they started to do analysis on it, find enormous content of carbonized wood in that, which then you get a slow release of carbon over a long period of time. There's another example of how we can enhance nature, extend stewardship of creation into something that nature only does in little pockets where you get some tree that's burned and left a little bit of charcoal. Here we can concentrate that, and in terms of the climate change issues and the carbon cycle, we can fix. Not going to be the answer, but it can be part, a very small part of the answer, to fix carbon and actually add it to soil. It's one of the major reservoirs for carbon in the carbon cycle, in its organic form into its gas form, is in its fixed form of vegetation. And that in carbonized wood will last a long time. So we can actually fix carbon in soil, and soil carbon is a even in the forest, it's like half of the carbon is in the soil. So those are examples, and in terms of personal theology of how the science and the beliefs mix. And what we'll do today then is take a look at that and how it gets put to work. Dim the lights a little bit. And those of you sitting on that side, after a bit, may want to move, because after we finish talking about this image, we're going to turn to the image on the wall over there. Okay, I first saw this image around 18 years ago in Ravenna, in a basilica, and I'll read the description of it in a minute. And when I saw it, I was transfixed as a forester.
wasn't studying as much of religion in those days. But as a forester, I was transfixed by it and spent an hour studying it. Then I went back there another 8 or 9 years ago and similarly sat and studied it and fascinated by it. And I want to give you the description of it. It is from a book by Rita Nakashima Brock and Rebecca Ann Parker, Saving Paradise, which you've been to any of Merritt's sessions. She's talked about two feminist scholars that have looked at the role of the cross in history. And they traveled all over the Middle East and Turkey and so forth, looking for images of cross in early Christianity. And this is one of the early churches, so the 6th century church. And it gives then some insights into what Christians believed and how they worshipped at that time. So first of all, we'll just look at it in terms of content, and then we'll reflect on it. And I'll talk about what I see as a forester, what you may see, which is not in necessarily the description that they would give, or you may have read in a guidebook if you've been there yourself. Unfortunately, this is a piece that I stole off of the web, this image, and it truncated the top, so we'll have to tell you what's up there. Okay. The apse mosaic in the 6th century church of St. Apollinaire in Classe, the ancient seaport of Ravenna, Italy, places beauty at the heart of the cosmos. At its center, a sapphire globe rests on an emerald meadow that stretches across the width of the apse. White lilies and daisies, red anemones, and mossy green rocks stud the meadow. Pine, cedar, and olive trees rise from it into a golden sky. Scattered among the flowers and trees are doves, partridges, parakeets, and larks. At the bottom center of the meadow, feet firmly planted in the grass, stands a white-robed saint labeled Sanctus Apollinaris, to honor the first bishop of Ravenna. Arms raised in the pose of an orant, the gesture of prayer, he welcomes and the worshipers into the paradise around and before them. Sheep flank him on either side, symbols of apostles. Above him to the right and left, three sheep represent Peter, James, and John. And John gazed at the huge globe. Silver and gold stars fill its blue field. The globe's gold and red frame is encrusted with emeralds, sapphires, and pearls. A large golden cross decorated with the same jewels transects its center. From the middle of the cross, encircled in a small medallion of pearls, the tiny bearded face of Christ peers directly out at the viewer, intense and grave. Just above the cross is written Ichthys Fish, the Greek acrostic for Jesus Christ, God's Son, Savior. Under the cross is written in Latin Salus Mundi, the world's salvation. The globe rests on a meadow, but it also seems to float into the gleaming sky that spans the upper portion of the apse. The hand of God peeks out of wispy pink and blue clouds at the top of the sky. Immersed waist deep in the heavenly clouds, two figures clad in flowing white togas hover on either side of the orb and point toward it. Their names are inscribed next to their faces, Elijah on the right, and Moses on the left, and we can just barely see them there. Elijah and Moses cue the viewer that this mosaic depicts the transfiguration. As told in the Gospels, the transfiguration occurs when Jesus, Peter, James, and John climb a high mountain, usually identified as Mount Tabor. There, before the eyes of the others, Jesus changes. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became dazzling white. His transfiguration unveils the hidden divinity within the flesh of his humanity. The three apostles see Elijah and Moses talking to him. A cloud of luminous mist rises and encompasses them, and from the cloud a voice says, "This is my son. the Beloved. Listen to him. When the disciples heard this, they fell to the ground and were overcome by fear. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, "Get up and do not be afraid." And when they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. And I'll just read on the next paragraph of their interpretation, because it's important to give it the context that they were giving it, at least in their view of how paradise emerges with the incarnation of God in the world. The mosaic portrays Jesus Christ as the face at the heart of the cosmos, a presence that shines with the night's stars and day's sunlit meadows. His radiant companions, Moses and Elijah, who had met God face to face at Mount Sinai, confirm the revelation. Both had taken refuge in the mountains in fear for their lives. Mount Moses's countenance had gleamed with reflected light after seeing God. Elijah had been transformed when God came to him, not in the thunder or the earthquake, but in a still small voice. Their encounters with God changed them. For Jesus' disciples, the mountain mist momentarily changes the whole landscape, opening into the realm of paradise where Moses and Elijah dwell. In that moment, they hear God's voice and see Jesus' divine nature shining forth. The worshiper standing before this image also stood in the presence of God shining forth. So that's what Nakashima and Brock and Parker tell us in terms of the meaning of this. And you'll find it in tour books not as detailed as their description, but much the same in terms of the general features of it. A lot of it's self-explanatory when you sit and study it for a while. So the question then here, first of all, is we see things with different eyes. And they are giving us how that could be seen, or perhaps they're guessing at how it was seen by worshipers in the 6th century. Now, as a forester, at the end of the 20th century, I sat there and looked at this, and I didn't see that at all. It's not the first thing I noticed. Can you guess what the first thing I noticed was?
What kind of the trees, yeah.
The trees, and what are the trees doing?
They're leaning towards cross.
The trees are small little baby trees, middle-sized mm-hmm. trees, older trees, big trees. This is a forest in process. These are trees in process. This is dynamic. And when you travel around to look at different churches in Italy and other places, very often you see images of the tree of life, which we'll look at in a little bit. There is no tree of life here. These trees are literally in process. Now, in a crude sense, as a forester, when I sat there, first of all, I said, "Hey, that's a managed forest." And if you look at it carefully, it is. Because how did people feed their animals back then? They lopped branches off of trees, and tell me if they haven't lopped the branches off of here to get the foliage or to use for some firewood. Those trees are not, if you look at them, they're trees that have been used. And then how did these trees get here? All ordered. It's an ordered forest, if you will. And where does the order come from? So the two things that I noticed immediately when I looked at this was, hey, there's something really unique about this in terms of the trees and their ages and the way in which they have been manipulated by humans, and there's no tree of life. Those two things just struck me right off. So this image of the cosmos, the role of the humans in it, the saint in care of the creation, in the worship of Christ, in bringing God down into life, was not something that said that the trees had to be kept sacred, separate from humans. They were literally intertwined with humans and human activity. And this is why I found that so intriguing as an image, and I troubled over it, because I kept asking, oh, these are rocks, but are some of these stumps and they're sprouting?
Yeah.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I've asked art historians and others, and never gotten a very clear answer. Do others of you see other things in there, or interpretations that I've made that you would disagree with? Yeah.
Well, I definitely saw stumps sprouting, like behind the sheep up on the left. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how else you can see.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just because.
And of course, in forestry, that's known as coppicing. They cut trees. There's a stump, cut a tree. That's the way I would read it. And those they would sprout and form new trees. Been in various places in the world with native peoples, and that's exactly the way they perpetuate the forest. Mm-hmm. For firewood, mm-hmm. fodder, whatever.
So it's kind of like, seems like it's a little bit like what you described earlier, you know, of, you know, yeah, we live here, and we live in, you know, paradise or the garden, yes. But, you know, there doesn't seem to be any mandate that we certainly are able to harvest, take, and then it looks like, maybe humankind is, if it's so ordered, and it wouldn't just grow randomly like that in the...
No, that's...
But maybe humans are having a hand in replenishing and partnering with God and, you know, managing the forest, harvesting, taking what we need to sustain ourselves, and working together to, a process of, you know, cycling.
Right. So that's the dynamics exactly that I saw in this, which I'm just intrigued by, yes.
You could see it a different way. You could see it as the bishop who's come in and rescued the forest from human manipulation.
Where was your evidence there on that? What would you see?
Well, I don't. Only your interpretation of it, or the idea that yeah. this is a managed forest. Perhaps this is, okay, we need to take better care of this. You know, I don't know. Just
yeah. Well, it's like anything. I mean, you could take all of the Bible, where all this was drawn from, and we can read it in any number of different ways, and sometimes interplaying those ways tells us a lot. Mm-hmm. There's no one answer that's going to give us all the truth. There are elements of truth and all, usually in these documents, and you have to figure out how that truth was stated in the context in which it was stated, and then what does that tell us about people at that time and place, and does that tell us anything about our lives? Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Yeah.
So, I don't remember the details of this, but didn't Ravenna, wasn't it competing with Rome to be the center for Christianity? Wasn't there a pope at Ravenna at this time?
Yeah, what happened was, and this is for those of you who have been there more recently, set me straight, because I learned this from Tor Books, studied as a scholar, is that about this time the tribes of the north were invading Rome and mashing things, so the church retreated to Ravenna, and the Pope lived there for a while, and then at the same time the church was splitting, if I recall, east-west, and so you had one time, I don't know where it was in relation to this, two popes, so this was a refuge site for the church when Rome was getting sacked, then later the church moved, well, Constantinople and then Rome.
So to what degree is this more in the iconic tradition, art tradition, where it's a flat representation of what will one day be perfected and meant to draw us toward that, showing that Eastern influence, and to what degree is this more of a Western mural?
Yeah, that's the question I don't have an answer to. I mean, in terms of its contents, mm-hmm. I can say what it tells me in terms of its contents, but which of those, and we'll look at a moment at another image of tree, which clearly is iconic looking at the future. Does this one Brock and Parker would tell us, this says something about the present. This says that, you know, God literally is resident in creation. This is the cosmos, and we live in it. That's what they say this represents, as paradise, and paradise can be lived on Earth as well as beyond in some other life reality. And that's what their whole book is about. And they see, they found these images all over the Mediterranean region in early Christianity, as well as in all the old, many of the old documents. So it's open to debate on it, yes.
Well, I don't think too deeply about these things, but overall I just looked at a very pastoral scene. Green is a very calming color. And what I like, though, is when you point out the possible stumps in the front with new growth, I like the idea there of from death, from the stumps comes new life, and it continues to grow and grow, and then those bigger trees are going to become cut down and produce new life. Kind of reminded me of years ago when I was up at Mount St. Helens a couple years afterwards, and even though it was totally devastated then, I took a picture of one stump that had a little growth coming out of it, and I just found that very inspiring. I also looked at those little sheep, and I didn't know that was a bishop or something. I thought that was Jesus, but I was looking at the sheep as us, you know, focusing on the creator of this pastoral scene.
Yeah. So let's take and move from this for a moment and look at the tree of life on the east wall, south wall. Can everybody see that? We need some more light on it. Let's see if I can get more light here. How's that? It's not that much. This was done, oh, I forget the name. Does anybody remember the name of the artist who was resident here? Who did all of the watercolors and paintings of the...
Christian Gellier.
Pardon?
Christian Gellier.
Christian Gellier. And this was painted several years ago for a theme that they had for the year. And it is another tree. And what struck me immediately when I saw this, and I think it's what, in fact, what was the intent of chapter 2 out of Revelation. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and the Lamb, through the middle of the secret city. On either side of the river is the tree of life, with its 12 kinds of fruit, producing its fruit each month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. Nothing accursed will be found there anymore, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. And there will be no more night. They need no light or lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever. So in the sense of the apocalypse as the revelation, the opening of the new, the death of the old and the opening of the new and the hope that comes with that. Here's another image of a tree. In the face of Christ in the middle. The yellow, we can't, unfortunately, if we could spot that, we'd see the yellow at the head of the water flowing from God. Two rivers at that image. Maybe four rivers with this other spill, I don't know. Talk with the artist. I didn't count 12 fruits up there the other day when I looked at it. So what does this tell you?
It's much wilder.
It's wilder. It's not ordered. A fusion.
In a way, it is ordered. It looks well pruned. If it's got 12 fruits on it, it has to have been grafted
Uh-huh, okay.
See?
So, all right.
I mean, it looks well ordered, too ordered.
Oh, maybe it's too ordered.
Except that the leaves and the fruits become very disproportional
and
prodigal.
So it's symbolic.
Yeah, they're very lush.
Yeah.
But the growth is really what's so evident.
Yeah.
There's leaves, more leaves on the left than the fruits on the right. Mm-hmm. Some fruits on the left, yeah. But like those.
Although the big difference I see is that in this case, humanity, Christ, what we want to call the face, is inherent in part of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, they're separate.
In one way, when I looked at these the other day, and I sort of reflected, my first reflection up here, you see one of the part of the tree is a lake coming down and roofing. Out of the face, and you can see the arms of Christ and the face and all. This is God is incarnate, in life, in this tree of life. And in the other image from Ravenna, Christ has overcome the world, and there's a new world, a new cosmos. And this is an ordered cosmos.
Do we see?
Because it literally another one. Here's Christ in the cross, and God above,
mm-hmm.
overcoming literally over the world. And the hierarchy, very important. The hierarchy in terms of trees. The trees represent, because to a lot of people all over the world, in terms of trees of life and images of trees are rooted in the earth, as here. Their body is something that stands with enormous strength in the midst of the world, and their branches reach up and touch the heavens and communicate with the mystical life and spirits from above. And they connect these two poles, the rootedness and the firmness of the earth with the mists and the sublime of the heavens. And that hierarchy is present in this image. It certainly is not present in terms of trees in the other image. The hierarchy there is Christ has overcome the world. God is now resident in the world. There is a new cosmos. This one is different than this. This is more consistent with some of the images one will see from people throughout the world, Nordic mythology, their god. Very similar to this in some ways, is resident in life. We have to do a lot of anthropology across cultures to really study that, but that's the contrast. We wanted to set this up just to answer some of these questions. And we'll work through that little sheet I handed out. If you didn't get a sheet, you can a little later, let me hand you one. If you didn't get a piece of paper. So let's look at, I was more through some of these questions. Question two, is the image of paradise in which the spiritual and the material are united in Christ, is this an image of that paradise? In that sense, given that you've been party to some of our other discussions this week, there's not a separation between the human and the wild. Everything is bound together in the cosmos into an ordered life, and humans are part of that ordering process. Is that what the mosaic from Ravenna would tell us, and at least in the interpretation that I've made, and others may make different interpretations. So is that paradise? Rock and Barker would say, yes, it's paradise. That's what people would experience in worship. They could begin to feel that unity of all life. And why that's important is where it leads to the third question. Does this portray salvation as an awakening of the whole world illuminating the divine presence? And this is something that I drew from reading an Eastern Orthodox Christianity, this question. That salvation is not some, you know, thinking of it as like, you know, all of a sudden I have a, you know, inbreaking of God and converted and accept Jesus as my Savior as an individual, which is one interpretation of salvation that's quite common in this society, but as an awakening of the whole world, that is to people collectively, together in relationship, as sensing the divine presence among them and with the world around them. That kind of image experience of incarnation is something that I find more of in Eastern Orthodox Christianity. And that's where that question came from, and that's what Parker and Brock draw on in their interpretation of this image of paradise. It's an image also of salvation. And that the sense of our participation in that changes us radically. It's really new. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's a little different than in a highly individualistic culture that we have. We often think of our individual salvation, not of our life together and our life not with just with one another, but with all of creation as something that we have to look at in terms of salvation.
This is question three?
This is question three.
In reference to the mosaic.
In reference to the mosaic. Or an image of paradise, and they came up with literally hundreds of them in various writings as well as in early Christian art. And I highly commend their book, It's Saving Paradise, if you're interested in that. And I'm simply trying to say, as a forester, I'm trying to make sense out of that image, and how does it connect, and what doorways does it open? And I'm not a theologian, and I don't intend to be a theologian. I'm trying to make sense out of how do we communicate across cultural barriers, disciplinary barriers, and I'm reaching out some little nodes there to say, this is what I see. And then it gets to the real heart of the matter that we have to talk about, I think, in terms of the church, and where we go in the future with regard to the environment, but specifically today in terms of forests. Is this image from Ravenna consistent with Paul's teachings about Christ and the law? And the reason this is so important is that modern environmentalism, particularly in the United States, has emphasized the law. So that it's built on the assumption there is no trust in society that these things get done unless it is specified in law and regulation. So we have all kinds of laws, all kinds of regulations. We rely on the courts for the interpretations. And then coupled with that is the moral law. The teaching of environmental ethics is a teaching generally of how you should behave. And I say that's just the Torah, the environmental Torah. This is what you'll eat, this is what you'll not eat, this is the light bulb you'll use, this is not the light bulb you'll use, and a lot of that makes great sense just as it did back in time they lived through Deuteronomy or whatever. But what does it do for us when we face a very complex, turbulent world? And I don't think this image is telling us that there is a law, a set of regulation, a code of behavior out of Deuteronomy. This isn't depicting eating laws of, you know, ancient Hebrews. This is saying love encompasses all, and we are transformed, and we are born literally anew in that new cosmos. That's what the salvation means. That's what I read out of that. Does anybody read something else out of it? And there's a spirit there that Paul would talk about. There's spirit in that image. That's its focus. But it doesn't communicate much else, like how I read it. So any comments on before we take this step to sort of look at law, both in terms of Christian or Hebrew morality and environmental regulation in the United States, where our poor environmental regulators literally live out of a rule book in great fear of the courts. And our environmental managers, including foresters, live out of rule books. And I've often thought, if I had taught in a little different university where it would be misunderstood, that perhaps we should be teaching the culture of environmental management in the United States by having people read Deuteronomy. That would, they'd understand the kind of world that they will be moving into. Rigid. Moral codes, yes.
There's a little bit of a sense in that one of natural law.
Uh-huh. How so?
Well, this, that there are sprouts coming up out of the roots, yeah. And so what one would have envisioned as death is actually new life, and
okay.
That there's something deeper going on there than just mm-hmm. what you would see on the surface.
Yeah. Cycles, hope, process, yeah.
I don't see that at all.
Yeah.
You know, I see management. What I see the forest out here is natural law, but I don't see that as natural at all.
Yeah. See, as a forester, I would say I look out here, and in some of the previous sessions I've had here, in a little trip that I took people on the other day, we came up with a very different interpretation. What we see out here is not natural, it's very unnatural.
Define natural.
Let me give you the, let's take a digression. I think we have a minute for a digression on that. Europeans came to the United States. Continent was occupied by Indians. We very efficiently removed them. Populations dropped by at least 95%. Pre-European America and the West, we had dry climates, hot, dry summers. Not the west side of the Cascades. Let's talk about what we're looking outside the door here. What did the forest look like? Well, let's take hillside. Scattered large trees, small clumps of smaller trees. Frequent fire. Every 25 to 35 years, fire would burn across the landscape here. Indians burned for a whole variety of purposes. Opened up hunting areas, visibility so they could see their enemies, creation of food resources, sprouting plants that they would eat, so forth. Europeans came, killed off the Indians, and said fire is a bad thing. We need to get it out of the ecosystem. We didn't say ecosystem, just get it out of the forest. It's an enemy. And we had a lot of religious symbolism. I had a lot of fun in my career talking about the fire demon. And only you can prevent forest fires. Mm-hmm. That comes right out of Calvinist thinking. Anyway. 100 years later, here we are. What do we got? You walk up here past the village and you're going to see this. You got trees growing all over the place. Under trees, the big trees here are about 250 years old. And now we've got trees that have come in the last 100 years, that are 100 years of age and less, crowded underneath. What happens today if a fire burns there?
There's all kinds of deadfall, too.
Yeah, dead wood down here. This thing whole goes up in flame and the whole forest is killed. That is unnatural. The crowding of trees here causes these little trees to have moisture stress, because there's only enough moisture for a few trees. They get insects, disease, they die, get the dead fuel. And we get big fires. So when I look at that landscape, I say, that's not nature.
Okay.
That's human misunderstanding of nature. Yeah.
So what I mean is more like untouched forest, virgin forest, is what I consider natural.
Where is that?
I don't know. You see what I'm saying?
I challenge you with that, because if we as humans have pumped carbon into the atmosphere at an unprecedented rate, and we're getting climate change, right?
The Native Americans, you said, they would allow this to happen, right? They would allow this.
They would allow it for thousands of years.
Okay, so wouldn't that be natural?
Yeah, but it's not there anymore.
I understand that.
Then let's take the next one, which is really interesting. If we add carbon to the atmosphere, and all of a sudden we've changed the climate, where is there anything natural anymore? If humans are the agent of unnatural. See, that's the conundrum. And why it's very difficult to talk about natural. And why if we look at an image, some people will see this as a natural forest, when in fact, as a forester looks at it, it's a fire trap. There's nothing natural about it at all. When I drove up on the bus here, people were saying it was a good fire that burned last year. It wasn't. good, it was just different. Burned under conditions where we allowed all that vegetation to accumulate. So anyway, I wanted to make that point because when we look at something as if it's natural, it's usually because it's in our heads as natural. And we have to then deconstruct that and say, what is it?
And it's really what we've lived with for a long time. It's only what we've seen.
What we've seen?
In our lifetime, and we think.
Just as it's a lot to do with the same sense of normal. Whatever we see people behave, that's normal. If I act a little different, it's abnormal.
So I guess that goes back to my question about whether or not that is an image of what is to be perfected one day, or is it an image of what is real in our midst right now? Is it?
Or is it both?
End times in the present, or is it what will one day be natural and perfected?
See, and as if I say I put on the hat of someone who says I'm working with nature to sustain, extend, and enhance, I would say that image tells me it's now. Because if we live in a world that we're radically altering through mistakenly keeping fire out of it, creating a lot of extra carbon in the atmosphere, which changes the climate, then in fact, we have no choice. We have to act. To not act is to allow it to further go into these unstable conditions. So we have no choice, in a sense. That means that if we live in that kind of a cosmos, where do we draw our inspiration? There's a whole, as we'll get to it in a few minutes here, perhaps it all starts with some sense of redemption that we are going to be new. We have to be new to live in this world if we're going to face our environmental problems. We can't go with the old. Yeah.
I was thinking a lot about what you talked about yesterday. And I see part of our problem is we've gotten to the point where we've separated humanity from creation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. In which humanity is evil and bad, but not part of creation. We set aside wilderness areas which we like to go visit that are untouched by humans, and then we live in our own space, which is not considered part of nature. We don't consider our cities part of nature. We talk about going out to nature instead of realizing that what we live in and what we create is part of nature. And I think that allows us then to hurt our creation because we've set aside an area which we consider to be creation, but we don't consider that we are part of creation anymore and that we are part of our own environment. And I think we need to find a way to rethink so that how we live, wherever we live, mm-hmm. we are living as a part of creation and realizing that we are part of the environment. We are not separate from creation and the environment.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Because you'd enjoy Parker and Bach's book. They have a section in there where we say exactly that. That by setting all these areas aside as wild and nature, then that what has permitted us to do is just to create all kinds of pollution, overconsumption, and to see that as just the way human is, rather than it's all creation and all has to be looked with far more sensitively. Yeah, that's a good point. So I wanted to move along to our other questions here before we come to a close today, if we've followed the problems of law, and then I guess to the question of realizing the kingdom of God, if in fact that's what this image represents, the one from Ravenna. And I think there is power to nature. There is power to trees. I have experienced power to trees going into my favorite redwood forest, the Rockefeller Grove in Northern California. I don't know if you've ever been into some of the redwood groves. But look up the Rockefeller Grove and go there. The trees are all up to right around almost 300 feet. And they're so thick that all that grows on the forest floor is green sorrel. So you get these massive red trunks and green sorrel. I mean, you walk into that and people whisper. In awe. So there is power in nature. So the real question is, what we've done, particularly in the latter part of the 20th century in implementing environmental law, if you're sensing there's something there, is to legalize it. So we said, got power, we're going to make sure it's governed by law so that that isn't disturbed. And if we have the separation of humans as evil and nature as wild and good, then the laws are designed to keep people from messing with nature. which is out there somewhere. And the legalization of the environment, of the power of the environment, of the spirit, if you will, that's in nature, if in fact we take this incarnational view seriously, is a stranglehold. And it gets to the question of greening churches. Because churches have a tendency to legalize things. A lot of guilt sometimes, a lot of morality. And what does it mean then to explore our relationships to creation? And are we doing that through understanding what it means to really live anew in all of creation in a far more active, dynamic sense, as opposed to, I'm going to follow these regulations. These are the moral codes that we have. So are we inventing a new environmental Torah? Or are we opening ourselves to a radical kind of transformation?
Aren't our churches, though, a lot more adaptive in how we legalize things, whereas in, at least in the current American legal system, what I find is as we learn more, we're not very adaptive in how we change our regulations in order to make the differences that we need to make. And it seems like our churches have more of that flexibility or agility to...
They're human institutions, they do and they don't. It depends on what you're talking about. I can express my own views. I'm somewhat ambivalent about formal church life, and I feel that way because there are, as a sociologist, I see implicit codes. There are things that you can talk about and things you can't talk about. These days, you can't talk about the Iraq War in very many churches. Okay? You can't talk about, people get really uncomfortable if you start talking about big houses, and in the Puget Sound region, big boats. Mm-hmm. You get down to some really core things people care a lot about. And an environmental transformation that is born through a sense of redemption might mean that a lot of the things we value today in terms of our material life will go away. That may be what it means to live on this earth in a full sense of stewardship. And that's hard. That's a hard conversation to have in the church, because there are implicit codes about permissible talk.
It's easier in the church to talk about using cloth napkins and ceramic mugs with our coffee rather than styrofoam cups. I mean, that's almost an easier, as opposed to me talking about how far I drove to work. Yeah. Because I chose to live in a rural community. I mean, there are just some of those that are so hard conversations to have, so have the easy ones.
See, and think about environmental stewardship, and as it grows out of an image, such as the one we had there from Ravenna, and I make sure I state this very clearly. I am not a leftist. I'm not a communist. I am going to talk about Cuba. But I talk about Cuba as an American who I identify as much or a lot more with traditional conservatism, not this wacko conservatism we see in power now. But back to the fundamentals of a core of life based in religion, in the traditions that really sustain us, in community life, in mutual responsibility, with the idea that we can't necessarily throw everything out and just start anew. We've got to build from what we have and move in a progressive direction. And when the Soviet Union fell, Cuba lost its food source and its oil source because the Soviets had used Cuba as their sugar plantation. And they would then supply them with food and oil in exchange. So overnight, I mean, the Soviet Union was a wreck. Sort of chaos. Overnight, Cuba had to figure out how to even feed your people. And what they did was not for the organized hierarchical structure of the state to go out and do anything. They said, the only way we're going to do this quickly is we're going to find out who knows how to grow food, particularly who knows how to grow organic gardens, and we're going to have to do this within a year or two. and they went around and they found that people were knowledgeable, and they developed these little small networks. They understood networks, they developed networks of people who understood that people who knew how to grow organic gardens became teachers. And they began to teach. Today, or actually within 5 years after the fall of the Soviet Union, 67% of the food that was consumed in Havana was grown in Havana, on rooftops, sidewalks, backyards. A radical transformation. And that's not to say that communism is good, that's to say that that kind of human adaptation is what we can do if we want to be creative. And that's the scale of transformation we're going to have to go through in order to live sustainably as stewards of the creation.
What do you have a vision of what do you think? What do you think is going to happen? Or I mean, like, you know, can you give us a picture? Like, okay, I'm from the west side of the state as well. Can you give us? You know, I mean, are we talking about Havana? Or, I mean, are we? What are we going to need to do?
I mean, I think that it's an unlimited. I mean, this is why I like what people say is process theology. Mm-hmm. We have unlimited creativity in us. Mm-hmm. We can do all this. We just don't want to give up on what we have.
Yeah.
That has to die. What we are, what we have, has to die. And if there is some kind of redemption going on here, as that image would suggest, we're going to give up on a lot of that stuff. And we're going to learn to live very differently, where Seattle itself could probably grow all of its own food, given the size of that city and the number of people in it, and the size in terms of the number of open spaces. Why not? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I understand that in Cuba, the first thing when the oil was shut off was that they imported hundreds of bicycles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Bicycles everywhere, yeah. And a law passed, you have to pick up a hitchhiker.
Mm-hmm.
No empty cars. Yeah.
The transformation of personal is pretty physical, and like you said, we're going to have to give up some of our luxuries. What about the corporate? I mean, that's, you know, legalizing the environment, the way you put it, I'm thinking about the corporate aspect of how we're raping our environment, mm-hmm. you know? So what is your take on that? How? I mean, I guess that's where I was coming from with all this mm-hmm. management. I was thinking about the corporate entities taking from the earth without any regard for ramifications.
Yeah, I mean, I would only guess. I really don't know. But looking at it, you know, put on a sociological hat, and we're going to have to come to a close pretty soon. But if you look at history, large institutions often grow to a point where they no longer are functioning for the purposes that people want them to function for. And it's not like there's going to be some revolution that takes them out. It's that the bottom drops out underneath.
So when we transform ourselves personally, these corporate structures are going to crumble.
Yeah, it's like what happened in Bechtel Corporation moved into Bolivia and had the idea that efficient water provision should be corporate. That's the best way to get people water. And of course, a lot of people, there weren't domestic water systems in a lot of the cities. They put water off of their tin roofs and so forth. Well, what happened was people had to start paying for water under a corporate provision. And these are poor people. They couldn't afford to drink water. So they rioted. They went in the street with massive demonstrations. And the corporation had to pull back on it. Today, the big corporations that control our food sources, the Monsantos of the world, are doing very similar things with food. At what point will people say, enough is enough? Because this is leading to enormous impoverishment of people.
Have you seen the documentary Broken Limbs?
No.
That's wonderful.
About the tree or the apple industry in
Yeah.
They have it up here. I saw it up here actually on a youth weekend in May.
It's very local, that's right.
Yeah, it's very local.
I'll have to look it up.
Yeah.
Anyway, those are some of the issues that come up as we struggle with this question of creation, and that image of, from Ravenna at least, told me that there is something to think about in terms of a kind of radical redemption from a viewpoint of all of creation. And and that it does start perhaps with our own redemption, not own being me alone, but as groups of people, networks, speaking, understanding, what do we need to do? And it certainly is not just to live by a set of moral codes or law. Yeah.
When we speak of environmental stewardship, the thing that bothers me a lot is that those with money do not feel that openness has any worth unless there's something on it.
Uh-huh.
You know, that the just itself is worthy until they put.
So nothing has value unless it's filled? Yeah.
When environmentally, of course, it's incredibly valuable.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening to our areas and our communities. It's a beautiful space. Well, we put it big houses, big.
Yeah, and part of thinking of in terms of the stewardship of creation would be we're in partnership with those trees, because if we don't have enough, trees do an enormous job of cleaning the air and providing oxygen. So how much do we need that in urban vegetation that alters the local microclimate, provides enormous cleaning of the air and so forth. And all those ecological functions get done without cost other than planting a tree and making sure it stays there. And that's where those openings actually have lots of life in them.
I'm kind of fascinated with the whole thing of putting the carbon into the ground. Is that something that people are actually doing some research? Is there research that you're aware of, or knowledge that's being? I mean, is it being? Has somebody taken the ball and running with that a little bit?
It's the organic farming types who are experimenting with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not something corporate agriculture is doing.
No, of course not. No.
But it's something that individuals are doing, saying, how do we grow a lot more food on a much smaller area? And extensive agriculture, as we have, is, in terms of land, very inefficient.
Right.
You can take a fraction of a big patch of land and actually grow the same food on it if it's done intensively with a lot of human labor.
Yeah, you need to see the broken limbs.
Okay. Thank you.
They don't talk about carbon, but they, other things.
Same idea. Yeah. Okay, one more thing and then we'll close.
We've just recently been to China, and one of the things that I learned there is that the government requires that every person plant 5 trees every year. If you're a family of 4, that means 20 trees have to be planted each year.
Yep.
20 trees.
Wow.
That was one of the few good things I saw.
Yeah. Well, I'm not opposed to planting trees. In fact, I find it as a great gift when, for instance, Jewish friends would send me a Christmas card, we planted a tree in your name somewhere in Israel, and that always meant a lot to me. It was a really nice gift. Yeah.